Welcome to episode 4 of Alternate Realities, the podcast series where we look at literally alternate realities, different perspectives on life, so that people who shared similar experiences can talk about what life was like from their perspective. We're all different, and we think that experiences should be the same, but actually everybody's is very, very unique to them. My guest today, as part of our remembrance for November, is the lovely Raquel Harper Titchener. Her husband, Major Matt Titchener, was officer commanding of 150 Provo Company, Royal Military Police, and sadly, Matt was killed on the 23rd of August 2003 in an incident in central Basra. Like all sudden deaths, it's a very difficult thing to take on board, and it's very difficult news to hear when we get that knock at the door. In Raquel's situation, you will hear as she talks today about how hard it was for her because of the circumstances she found herself in. So I welcome Raquel to the show today. Good afternoon, and a very, very big welcome to my guest today, who's a wonderful lady that I met through the Army Widows Association. Her name is Raquel Harper Titchener, and she's another Army widow, and I'm looking forward to having a chat with you today, Raquel, so welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Jay.
Well, we met quite a long time ago now, didn't we? And I want to come later on to your work that you do with the AWA. But, you know, first I'd like to sort of talk about how you became an Army widow, and sort of if we could start off with how you met your husband, Matt.
Seems like an eternity ago. So it was actually 1993, and I was a student at Manchester University at the time. And I hadn't been feeling too well, and a friend of mine was heading off to, she was a member of the OTC, and she was heading off to the ball, and they were short staffed behind the bar. And obviously lure of cash in hand to a student, you can imagine, dragged me out of my bed. So I was told to bring a dress to change into later because it was going to be an honesty bar. So off I went, and I was working behind the bar, and it became apparent there was a guy who kept waiting for me to serve him. As the evening went on, he would kept reappearing. And when I eventually was able to go out onto the dance floor afterwards, I was doing the locomotion, Kylie Minogue.
And he As you do,
yes, a bit of a bop. And he appeared at my side, and I think it was probably one of the worst chat lines I've ever heard when he asked me to show him, if I could show him the moves to the locomotion. So, he did not bad. He was quite a good mover. And really, as you say, from that point, the rest is history, I suppose. That's how we met in those initial days. I went back to Scotland for the Christmas holidays. I should have said that was November time. And Matt was up there. He was due to move up. He had come up to do a kind of recce. He was getting moved up to take over the cadet training team. And he was in the King's Regiment, the infantry at the time. So he was due to take that post up in the following January. And when I had left to go back to Scotland, it was kind of sort of, he'd said about, you know, could we meet for a coffee? And I'll show him about the sights of Manchester. So anyway, after the holidays, I arrived back to my halls of residence to find a letter. That shows you how long ago it is now.
That's all we had back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know. No, none of this fancy texting or anything like that. So there was a telephone number on the letter, and I thought, oh, why not? So the payphone in the halls of residence, again, no mobile, and I phoned him, and we made arrangements to go out. And our first date was in January at 94, January 94, that would have been then. And that's us. That's how we met, and that was it. Yeah, it just went from there.
So you were, I believe, in your first year at uni when you met Matt.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So how was it starting a romance when you've also, you know, you're in your first year of doing a degree as well?
Yeah. Oh, I don't think, I think from that moment, I was probably more interested in my social life than I was in my actual course. And it became apparent very quickly that the course I was on wasn't for me. And in fact, university life really wasn't that appealing. I loved the social side of it, and I became what they called senior students, so I organized all the events in the halls and things, but much to my mum and dad's disappointment, I think I realized that I wasn't going to stay, and I actually at that point had applied to Strathclyde Police and found out I got accepted. So I actually only stayed at uni for that first year, and I left in that summer. But Matt and I obviously by that point had been dating sort of 6 months, and within a year we were engaged. And I had moved back to Scotland and had joined Strathclyde Police. So, yeah, I didn't really go on to do the student life at that point.
So you went to join the police force, and that was kind of a bit of a curveball, really, wasn't it, from being a student and having a social life to suddenly be putting a uniform on. How long were you actually in the police force?
So in total, 10 years, albeit I had maternity leave from our first child. So I had just short of a year off with Matheson. And then I took a career break after Matt was killed. And that career break was a kind of safety net, albeit I was still technically employed. So I didn't put my final kind of sort of notice in until the exact 10-year point. So that would have been 10 years sort of officially on the books, as you like.
So you were actually still serving as a police officer then when your husband got killed?
Yes. So I actually, at that point, I had gone Monday to Friday because I was pregnant with our second child. So I had a desk job at that point. When Matt had deployed to Iraq, I was just short of 12 weeks pregnant. And when he was killed, I had just had my 20-week scan. So I was still working. I was still full-time at that point. But as I say, it was like obviously an office job at that point.
That is really very, very sad to hear. And I'm sure that anyone listening to this is going to relate to it, because I know that, you know, obviously, you know, that Gary was killed in the Falklands, and, you know, many of the women at the time, you know, had either very young babies or, you know, they might still have been pregnant. And it's a massive, massive shock to get that news and get that knock on the door any time. But how was it for you, Raquel, you know, being pregnant at the time?
I mean, I suppose at the time before Matt deployed, it was kind of when I found out, when I had sort of thought I was pregnant before I did the test, Matt was still back, obviously still with us at that point, and he was really keen. We were away on a family celebration, my mum's birthday, and he was really keen for me to do the pregnancy test. And I was, no, you know, it's a bit early. And the strange thing was, I had then had taken my mum away for a night, and he had headed back to the quarter with Matheson, our son. And for some strange reason, I decided that I would do this pregnancy test whilst I was away with my mum. And I remember just disappearing into the bathroom. And when I came out, obviously found the test was positive. And I phoned Matt. And I remember his response. He was quite kind of downhearted that I had decided to kind of do the test without him. And I remember my words to him were, well, I'm going to have to bring this baby up on my own anyway. And now looking back at that, whether that was because I knew he was going to be deploying, you know, within sort of that period of time, what I meant by that, you just think, you know, how ironic. Because, yeah, so...
Because it is, it's a huge part of any force's wife, you know, our life with our men away, you know, which they're frequently away, whatever regiment they're with. You know, it's a huge part of our life to almost be a single parent anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you very much, you know, you come used to that, you know, even with Matheson, you know, Matt probably spent quite a, you know, the majority of the sort of initial time away. We were fortunate to get a posting that enabled us to actually have probably the most normal life, sort of home life, that, you know, we would have had probably in that sort of in service. And again, I think, you know, everything for a reason, because that was technically like our last posting before he deployed. So we actually had a fabulous year of living as normal as you could as a military family, with both of us, you know, being able to work and coming home and basically sharing the childcare between the two of us. Because that rarely happens, you know.
It is actually very, very rare that you get that. And I think when you do get it, you sort of, you lap up every second, don't you? Because it's just so precious, the time that you get. So where what was he doing during that year? Where was he actually stationed at the time?
So at that time, he was stationed at Edinburgh Castle, and I was in Strathclyde Police. So we had a quarter. We were fortunate to have a quarter just outside of Glasgow. So they accommodated that because we wanted to live together as a family, and it meant I didn't have to give my job up, and I, you know, I was able to stay working, which was important to me at that time, especially with the kind of threat of deployment sort of looming. It was one of the best years we had. You know, socially it was fabulous as well. We were on a patch, and, you know, we made some amazing friends, and in fact probably that I've made friends from that patch that, you know, have been a real source of support, you know, after, especially after Matt was killed, and similar, you know, kids similar ages and things. So it's a kind of, it was a bittersweet in the sense that it was one of the best years, but obviously it led to something that was one of the worst as well.
It's interesting, actually, because the year prior to Gary's death, I guess, apart from when we were in Berlin in the very early days of our marriage, that again was, you know, apart from the exercises and the things that they have to go and do, you know, well, they may be away for a couple of weeks here and there. You know, our last year together was the same. It was quite ironic as we're talking about it. I'm thinking of that, you know, because we were stationed in Aldershot. So, you know, for the Maine, he was in camp and, you know, then home, and he was away a little bit more because Gary was, you know, a footballer and played for the battalion team. So, you know, whenever that, there was a match away, then he would be with that as well. But, you know, you have that family life that is so treasured and so rare, isn't it, when you are a forces wife?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I know that Matt was killed, and I know this is a really tough one, and I think it'll touch a lot of people's hearts, and I kind of, I feel a bit sort of emotional just sort of talking about it, because when you are that person that's had that knock on the door, you really relate to other people that have too. And so how long had he actually been in Iraq when he got killed?
So Matt had deployed out to Iraq in just start of June 2003, and he was killed on the 23rd of August 2003. So not really that long. You're talking probably just short of three months, not even that, two 3 months, and the kind of, so whether, I don't know, so I always kind of look back, he was due to come back for an R&R, and he swapped it with one of the other guys because one of the other guys, it was his child's birthday. So he should have been home before that time. And you often wonder, would things have been different if we hadn't? And not that you can do that ifs and buts, but we had sort of spoken about coming back, and because it had been changed, our kind of last phone call together was very much focused on him coming home for that leave that he was going to have. And, you know, obviously Matheson, he wanted to get Matheson a present. And so he'd asked me if I could get that, you know, for him. And when he spoke to Matheson on the phone, Matheson had asked him for a blue plane, which we still have.
Oh, bless him.
So he got a blue, but the sad thing was Matt never obviously got back to give him that plane. So it was kind of many months later that I gave him that plane and just said that that was a gift from his daddy. So
how old was Matheson when Matt died?
He was only two and a half. And it's strange because I suppose a lot of people don't give kids maybe that much credit, but although he was 2.5, my memory was very kind of, he knew very much in his own sense of what was going on, you know, and the understanding, obviously not nowhere near like an adult's understanding, but he certainly had some form of concept of what was going on, and he quickly knew and understood that his daddy wasn't coming home. And amazing to watch, you know, how he kind of sort of dealt with it in his own way as well. Kids do surprise you. They really do surprise you, but they're also a great source of support as well, especially for me at that time, because obviously being pregnant and having such a young child, I had to focus on them, so it probably helped me more than I realised to have that sort of thing to focus on.
Well, it's a very, very important and a very big reason to get up in the morning, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, one of the things you do go into that autopilot of, you know, everything becomes kind of sort of, you know, you sort of go day to day, and to have something like that, like another, you know, purpose and a meaning, it certainly gets you through some of the worst and darkest times.
And there are plenty of them, sadly, aren't there?
Oh yeah, sadly, yeah. And even many years on, you still can, it's like being hit. You can hit a brick wall, as you know, you just comes from nowhere and can take you right back there, all the different triggers. So you never really ever get over it. That's what I always say that to people. It's, you know, and they say, oh, you know, so many get over it. And it's a thing I hate. I always say, no.
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
I remember a few years ago, I was actually down in Aldershot, and I bumped into somebody that I hadn't seen for many, many years. And this other guy was with him, and they were talking, and he said, so have you got over it then, Jay? And this chap that Gary and I had known back in the 70s just looked at him and said, don't be so stupid, man. You know, you don't get over things like that.
No.
And it was so lovely and so open and so honest to hear somebody say that.
Yeah.
And I actually really felt for the guy that had asked the question, because he was just like straight down his neck, you know. But it's true, you know. And you know, I know you're aware that one of the things I've done in the past is I was a bereavement counsellor, and you know, that last and that end stage of grief is acceptance, and that's as good as it gets, isn't it? You know, when you get to that point where you've actually accepted, you've gone through that process. But, you know, that's it. That's where you're at with it.
That's the best you can hope for.
So did you get the same sort of thing as happened with me then? Did you get that? I know there's a survey going on at the moment, isn't it, which is actually called the knock on the door. Did you get that knock at the door? And
Yes.
Were you at home at the time?
Oh, it was a wee bit complicated in the sense that we had the quarter, we had moved quarters, and because Matt
prior to being deployed to Iraq, got a kind of sideways sort of, I suppose they called it a kind of slight promotion. And he got moved to Catrick. So we took a quarter on down in Catrick. But because I was still working, I actually moved into my mum and dad's house because it was, their house was empty and they were away. They were living in Jersey at the time. So it made sense for me to move in there. And it gave us a base for me to still continue to work. But obviously then on my days off and things, I would get down to Catrick where Matt was in the lead up because we had about 4 or 5 months at Catrick before he deployed. He was originally meant to go out in the first stage. He was meant to go out in the March and then it got changed and he was going out in the second. I think that's when for me, I just became very uneasy about the whole deployment. If he had gone out on the first one, I think, you know, you always think they're more sort of aware and it's obviously that kind of everything's heightened and, you know, but the minute they move into that second phase, it always concerns me that guards start to come down a little bit and things become a bit more more focusing on trying to peacekeep then. And it's, you know, I think for that's where my uneasiness started. It's probably when it really dawned on me that this was happening. So this was for us as a couple as well. I should say that this was the first deployment that I'd had with Matt, albeit he'd been in Cyprus and places he'd never actually been, Northern Ireland and things. But even that, you know, I come from Northern Ireland, so I suppose for me it was like that's home and things. So really I didn't have any kind of previous experience of a kind of deployment to somewhere like that with Matt. So that in itself brought its own, you know, worries.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, that's the one thing that you and I do have a big difference in is that, yeah. You know, Gary was, when we came back from Berlin, he was actually on an 18-month tour in Ballykinler.
Oh.
And so we had our daughter's first birthday party and in the July. So, you know, they get a long leave, you know, when you're coming back from a long posting. Mm-hmm. And then he went to his posting in Ballykinler 2 days after her first birthday.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had made a decision, which I'm so great. I'm so glad now that I did make that decision because I think having got PTSD, if I'd actually gone to Northern Ireland, it would have been a lot harder on us, you know. It was hard. It's always hard having a separation, but, you know, there is that being in the thick of it. And of course, it was a month, you know, just over a month after he got onto that posting that Tuparo were hit with Warren Point.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I think I can really relate to what you're saying, that when your husband goes away on that first ever deployment, wherever it is, where there is, you know, in inverted commas, trouble.
Yeah.
You know, it's the one where the fear starts to really rise, isn't it? Because you then become far more aware of what could be and what could happen.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah. No, it's certainly not an easy... And I don't know, I suppose, I mean, obviously I didn't get the chance to find out that out, but I don't suppose it gets any easier the amount of times they do deploy. I think the worry is always going to be there, isn't it? But yeah, not easy times.
It can't be, because when you love somebody and they're going into potentially harm's way, then, you know, you carry that burden with them. You know, it's that she who waits. And, you know, the force's wife really goes through it, you know, with that whole thing. And I've got a very good friend of mine that I've known since the 80s. And she always says to me, you got that knock on the door, because I, you know, her husband was in the military for quite a long time. And she said, you got that knock on the door that we all dreaded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? Yeah, definitely. I mean, that, you know, I think one of the things that obviously that knock on the door survey that has certainly brought about has been the varied experiences, you know, within the military family, and certainly even within the Army Widows Association, talking to, you know, the girls, the kind of experience that one has had compared to another can be just like night and day. So, you know, thankfully things, you know, have improved. I mean, we can always get better at things, you know, you never get perfection. There's always areas that you can keep improving on. But I do think, having listened to some of the stories, looking back, you know, there definitely has been improvement. And I know, obviously, the survey caused a lot of, you know, upset for many people. But unfortunately, it's that double-edged sword, isn't it? You know, unless you're willing to kind of open up and maybe bear that kind of, you know, open that sore, that wound again, and, you know, look at these things and share those experiences. Without that, we can't, you know, we can't improve on, you know, on these sort of things. I mean, certainly for me, I suppose my experience, had it not been me, would have probably had quite an awful effect. And I do always think I was very fortunate that, having been, you know, obviously a serving police officer at the time, having delivered that news many a time, having to be the person doing the knock on the door,
yeah,
probably did give me that bit of oomph, and I don't know if oomph's the right word, but that bit of kind of almost familiarity of what was happening, and without, you know, having to dealing with that news in itself is horrific, but then having that kind of that unknown, whereas I kind of knew what was going to, the sort of procedure almost, I suppose, if you like, the formalities of it. I ended up, I mean, I actually felt just deep sorry for the poor man that came to the door.
You know what, I did. I mean,
yeah,
not obviously in that moment, because it's that massive shock, isn't it? But you know, as time went on, and people would say to me, well, how were you told? And I said, well, obviously, you know, they came to the door, and you know, mine was sort of 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. So,
yeah.
And I'm always very open about this when I do interviews, you know, I say, yeah, you know, I remember lying in bed, and it was so bizarre, because it was that May was really hot.
Yeah.
It was so hot. And yet I had my winter dressing gown on, and I was in bed shivering.
Oh.
Because I kind of just knew, I had this thing that I just knew anyway. And I remember lying there, and it's so logical, isn't it, at the time, these thoughts that go through your head, you know, they sound ridiculous afterwards, but at the time you're thinking with what you think is perfect logic, you know. Yeah. And I remember lying there thinking, if I just ignore the door, because they'll just go away.
Yeah.
And then within kind of a split second, the next thought comes into my head, don't be ridiculous. You know, they're only going to come back. You can't avoid this.
Yeah.
And I just knew, because it was an 8 a.m. on a Sunday morning. It was highly unlikely it was anybody coming around for a coffee, you know.
So,
You know, so that was it. But I know that there has been a lot of horror stories that I have heard over the years, and you know, I totally agree with you, there is changes that go on and things do get better. In my particular case, though, I have to say that it was 1982, and it was a very different time then. But I did get, I mean, I whoever it was, I still to this day don't know who was it that knocked on the door and told me. I just know it was an officer and his wife. But they made sure that I wasn't on my own. They went and got somebody, and, you know, they were as good as they could be, you know, which is quite unusual back then. You know, from the other things that I've heard. But I remember us sitting having a drink, you know, after one of our meets, and, you know, it was something that you were quite surprised, because you hadn't thought about it before, about the whole repatriation thing. And sort of saying, you know, how it took 6 months to get that whole thing together. And I think that was the massive thing about 82 that was so different, because it hadn't been done before.
No. I mean, when we obviously had talked about that, my heart just went out to you. That length of time is just horrendous. We thought it was long enough in Iraq, you know, and you were talking sort of weeks. Just awful. I mean, it's just because it's that limbo. It's you've had that news. So it's, you're needing to move forward on that. And until you really either see them or see, you know, the representation of what you've been told, you just can't move forward on anything. You know, there's no dealing with that. And obviously the longer that takes, the harder it must be.
It was. And, you know, when I look back on it now, I kind of look back on it and I'm very proud, actually.
Yeah,
we did fight so hard to get that. I mean, for me, it was a no-brainer because I had promised Gary faithfully. We talked about it at length, especially after Warren Point, you know.
Yeah.
And I had promised him faithfully. He had this thing about being cremated. And he said, whatever happens, girlie, make sure that I'm cremated. Even if I, you know, get taken out by a bomb in Northern Ireland, whatever, just make sure I'm cremated. And that was a promise that I made to him. So I think the thing that broke my heart the most was not being able to fill that promise. You know, I couldn't fulfill it because, you know, it was what it was. He died sort of when they'd only been on land a week. And secondly, even if things had been different sort of at that time, there was no crematorium on the Falklands. So the only way I could fulfill his wishes was to have him repatriated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, it does warm my heart a little bit, although, yeah, it was horrendous. I mean, 6 months waiting for a funeral, it just... You know, you are just hanging there in limbo.
Yes, just that limbo, yeah.
But when I talk to people like you and when I kind of see that, however sad it is, you know, these things are going to happen while we have servicemen and women in harm's way. That's just the way life is. But the fact that, you know, that time in 1982 did change history and it was the first time, it does warm my heart a little bit that people can actually have that proper funeral now.
Yeah, I know, and you should be rightly so. You should be proud, you know, and I think that's, you know, one of the things about military widows in every sort of stage as we go along, there'll be something you'll see that happens, you know. I would say we're quite a feisty bunch.
We are indeed, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think we can stand up on our own 2 feet in amongst it, and you know, we're well used to putting ourselves out there to you know, say what we think. And
coming on to that, you know, you actually have had a very long association with the Army Widows Association, haven't you?
Yeah. So the Army Widows officially was formed in 2004. Apparently there had been many years prior to that, there had been an attempt to set something similar up, but it didn't really get the backing from the MOD or the military. I think there wasn't maybe the clout behind it at that time. So after Iraq, they decided that there was obviously a lot, you know, of younger widows were starting to come on the scene, and it became very apparent that they really did need something. And obviously, I suppose as well, in the sort of society, you know, because obviously there were lots of younger widows in previous conflicts, including the Falklands, obviously, like yourself. But I think with the sort of use of social media now, that certainly has put a voice, and it makes, you know, it makes things probably a lot more available to the general public. So that you're probably, I would say, more accountable now, maybe be the case that, you know, people are, like the likes of the MOD and the military can be held more accountable. So very quickly, this obviously was decided it was something that was needed in the Army. And Heather Saunders, who is the kind of founding member, was approached. And it really kind of went with Heather and a couple of other girls who sort of got together in a living room and chatted about it, and then sort of started to kind of, well, how are we going to kind of get in touch with these widows? And, you know, obviously then the sort of word was put out through the sort of channels. And, you know, come sort of 2004, I attended my first sort of gathering. At that point, I mean, there weren't that many sort of obviously sort of there. It was very informal. It was at Amport House, you know, and it was kind of, everybody was kind of sort of, I suppose, fumbling around in the dark. And to begin with, it was a wee bit like, I suppose, one of the wife's clubs. And, you know, it's certainly, let's say, even the Army Widows Association, I would say, has definitely evolved over the years. And again, we've learned, you know, what works and what doesn't work, because, you know, it's one of these things. I mean, it's when we first started, I remember we had to introduce ourselves and say who our husband was and how they'd been killed. Now, looking back at that, you think that's horrendous for anybody who, you know, there are, you know, some people don't want to talk about that. So, you know,
especially if it's really early days and yeah. it's really raw, it's hard to even get the words out, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely. And I think that's probably one of the beauty of things, of the association, is that we have all grown together. You know, a lot of us who were there right from the start have been able to kind of see, you know, that sort of grow and see what has worked. And, you know, I'm not saying by any means that it's perfect in any sort of sense, but I think that everybody's really kind of accepted that the sort of main thing about the Army Widows is that we've all gone through the same loss of that military loved one, which is a common bond. And it, as you know, I think we've spoke about that before, the difference between losing a military loved one to a civilian, you know, obviously the actual loss itself and the grief and, you know, is no different. But for military bereaved, for the military bereaved family, you know, they're losing, you know, obviously a way of life, their house, their friends, their, you know, and I think we spoke about that in depth before, and it just adds even more to it. And that's one of the great things about the Army Widows Association, is that we're all able to relate to that, and we've all got our own experiences. And you know,
that is such a huge thing, because in civilian life, and this is one of the things that as a form of bereavement counsellor, you would advise people not to consider moving for the first year.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because you're going to have to go in that first year through every anniversary. You know, it's going to be the first birthday without them. It's going to be your wedding anniversary. You know, it's going to be Christmas. It's going to be all the anniversaries. And the first one is going to be the rawest because of obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And so in Civvy Street, as a bereavement counsellor, you would recommend that people, unless they have to, they just try not to put that decision off for, you know, 12 months and get through mm-hmm. that and get some clarity about, you know, what next. And as you so rightly say, the thing is, when you're in army quarters, you literally within a very short space of time get a license to stay, don't you? And
yeah.
you have to be out.
Yeah.
And so you're losing your home, but you're losing your way of life. You're losing absolutely everything that you have known for whatever length of time you have been married.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, it is. It's just that added extra. And as you say, to try and make decisions like that, it's, you know, in those early days, I mean, it's bad enough at any time, but especially in that first, you know, those first sort of raw, crucial kind of days and months, it's, you know, it's so difficult coming to try and terms with the loss plus, you know, what's going to happen next. No, it is. It's not easy at all. No.
Well, it was particularly hard for you, being, you know, 20 weeks pregnant and having that to deal with. My heart goes out to you, Raquel, because, you know, it's never easy. This is one of the hardest things you'll ever have to face in life. It's, you know, losing your spouse. But I can't even imagine how hard that must have been to go through that and not share that with the person that you love.
Yeah, I mean, she's now coming 17, and I mean, she, you know, and she's called Angel. And
was that a name that you'd picked out before, or did you call her that?
So Matt was convinced I was carrying a girl, and I was like, no, it's another boy, it's definitely another boy. And he was like, no, definitely, I'm convinced this one's a girl. And he basically referred to my bump as Angel, Daddy's little angel. So we'd spoke about other names. That wasn't really a name as such. It was a more kind of term of endearment for the bump, if you like. So when Matt was killed, and I had gone in for a scan more or less sort of 2 days later. They wanted to just check everything was okay. And at that point they said, I know, you know, you didn't want to know what you were having, but do you want to know now? And I said, yes. And they actually, I mean, it was one of the kind of probably most emotional times, and the staff were excellent. And they actually had, I think, about three different people look at the scan, because I think they were so worried in case they told me something that wasn't right. So they said 99.99% positive. You know, like they left themselves out wee point, whatever. It's a girl. And at that moment, that was probably actually the first time I burst into tears at any point in front of anybody. It was probably the first and last in that sort of time, if you know. And it was just, I was obviously just so delighted that it was a girl, because that it made me feel Matt had that connection as well. And it just, I couldn't have called her anything else then, because I just was like, well, it's got to be Angel. So that's where he called the bump. And it was, she was, you know, just suited her. And at 17 years come now, it still suits her. And I think the most probably heartbreaking thing is, as you know, as you understand as well, as they go through the biggest kind of things in life for them, all the different, you know, occasions and events and transitions, and you just wish, you know, he was here to see it. And that's, yeah, it's probably, I always say to people, as the years go on, I still miss him, and you know, and I think about him all the time. You know, there'll not be a day that goes by that I don't. But I probably find now my grief is probably more for my kids, and I look at what they probably missed out, and you know, in years to come, because you know, that's probably now the hardest thing.
I totally relate to that one. It's that whole thing, isn't it? That is things like just like that first day at school, and
yeah.
You know, but for you, you've had every single milestone, that you know, the first word, the first step, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's huge.
It is, yeah, it is. And, you know, I had was criticised, actually. I did an article, a media article, when not long after. I mean, we were being kind of hounded at the time, and
that one.
And I was kind of advised, if I did one, you know, like chose one sort of paper, or whatever, that would kind of kill it a wee bit. You know, it would kind of sort of get them off my back for a while. So it was very much on my terms, and I did do. And one of the things that I asked them to actually publish was the scan picture. And a lot of people found that very strange. Why would I want my scan picture as part of the kind of, and for me, it was, I wanted to create something for Angel, you know, for the future, that she knew, so that she would know looking back that she was very much part of that whole, you know, thing. And I know that sounds probably a bit strange, but you know, there were photos obviously for Matheson to look at, and he had, albeit it was only 2.5 years, there were still things there, like hard evidence, hard proof for him. And I wanted her to have something to know that she was very much thought of and spoken about. And so I suppose, yeah, it was.
So just a thought is coming into my mind, because I know that, you know, it's something that it's kind of life, isn't it? It's a human foible that we're very good at criticizing, you know. And so whatever you do, somebody will find fault with it, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But out of the people that found, I don't find what you're saying at all strange. I totally get where you're coming from, and I'm just, the first thing that's coming into my mind is, out of the people that criticized you, had any of them actually had that knock on the door?
No.
There you go, you see.
No, interestingly enough, no.
I think, you know, it's like so many things in life, you know, you might think, for example, if you've never had a miscarriage, like, why would somebody get so upset about it? You know, you weren't even showing and it wasn't even something you could feel or really. Well, that's not how any woman feels the minute she knows she's pregnant. Doesn't work like that. It's always amazing. And do you know, something happened last year that I hadn't, there's somebody I went and had a drink with I hadn't seen for years. And you know, those kind of acquaintances that pop in and out of your life and you may not see them for a long time, that kind of, you know, relationship. And we'd known each other years ago, and we'd sort of done a hi, how you doing sort of thing, and we hadn't spoken for a while. So he sort of said, oh, I've had a terrible time. My wife died. And so I said, I'm terribly sorry to hear that. And we met up for a drink and had a chat about it. And he looked at me, and I thought this was so generous and so mature of him to say this, because it's the sort of thing a lot of people wouldn't like to admit. And he said, you know what, Jay? So when I met you all those years ago and you told me that your husband had been killed in the Falklands, it meant nothing to me, and I'm ashamed to say that.
That takes a lot for somebody to say.
It does. And I said to him, wow, okay, well, you know, and he just said to me, he said, you know, now I've been through it. And I just said, look, you know, there's nothing to feel ashamed about. I get where you're coming from, and I'm really pleased to hear you say that to me. It does mean a lot to me, because there are so many people that don't get it and think they actually think they do, but they really don't. I mean, when Gary died, both sets of parents were alive, nobody been through a bereavement, so you know, nobody got what I was going through at all. You know, it's a very human thing, though, isn't it? We're experiential creatures. We don't get it until we've experienced it. And that, to me, is like finding the AWA has been fabulous, because you don't have to explain anything. Yes. Everybody is in the same club for the same reason.
No, definitely. And that's what it's about, is being able to have that kind of, without saying a word, but just knowing, and just, you know, just that kind of being in that group with people that just understand. And as you say, you don't have to explain, and it's just that acceptance and the kind of, you know, it's certainly a unique group and a fabulous support network.
Well, it may not have been a club that any of us particularly wanted to join, but being in the situation that we're in, it's a great club to belong to. That's how I feel about it. And you're chair of the club at the moment, aren't you? You are the association. Yeah. So you really are very heavily involved in it.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's like, you know, I mean, that's, I'll be coming up, this will be 3 years that I'll have been chair for. And obviously I had done other roles within it, but for me it's time, you know, I felt it was time for me to be able to give back. I was able to kind of give something, because I just got so much from it. And you know, I don't think, even right down to just knowing, as you say, you know, with a lot of what I call silent members, but you know that they're there, and you know, you can see that they've maybe looked at something, or they've, you know, just put a wee thumbs up at something, or you know, and just, you know, it's, that's what's so wonderful about it. There's no pressure, you know, it doesn't matter if you want to be a silent member and just, you know, read the kind of literature that comes in, or look at the newsletter. And you know, and then it, certainly during lockdown, it was amazing that we actually had an increase in members who finally decided, well, I'm going to join the Facebook group page. I'm not a fan of Facebook or whatever reasons, you know, for but they decided, oh, I'll, you know, during lockdown, I'm going to do it. And, you know, the amount of support that they've got from that group. And then, you know, members who have never been to an event before and decided during lockdown to just take the plunge and come on to one of our Zoom gatherings, which is amazing and so brave as well. I've got to say, I mean, And I said that to one of the girls that came on. I said, I've got to say, I says, and I know you had said, you know, you didn't have the courage to come to one of the events and things. I says, but for me, I says, coming onto a Zoom meeting takes a hell of a lot more courage than turning up in person. I says, you actually are braver than you think.
You know, I was one of those silent members. But as you and I have got to know each other, you know, you're very aware that was nothing to do with the Army Widows. It was because I'd been so terribly ill. And by the time I found you, I was kind of in that, you know, really difficult place. And so I think, you know, that's the thing that I definitely would 100% recommend the association, because you're so allowing as a group of women, of people being able to just be there and be a silent member if they wish to be. Yeah. And I think whether it's because of what happened with me and I was terribly ill and I wasn't able to socialize a lot with anybody, you know, I could put a mask on every now and again when I needed to go and do something, but that was about it, you know. But to get together with a group of women, you know, no way, I wasn't ready for that. And being able to be the way that you are, it did enable me, and I'm very thankful for that, Raquel. You know, it really enabled me to slowly edge forward towards it and to be able to, you know, feel that there was absolutely no pressure. If I joined in or whether I didn't, I was always invited and I was always included, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And that is, you know, that is what we try, you know, to make sure we get across, that, you know, it doesn't matter whether you've been a member for a day or 10 years, you know, when you're ready, it's your pace, and, you know, we're always going to be here. So, and the other beauty of it is there's such a variety of women in the group, you know, so you will find somebody, you know, it's like life. I mean, one of the things you always say is, you know, working with a group of women can be an absolute nightmare. But certainly in this association, you know, there are lots of personalities and lots of people from, you know, various backgrounds and et cetera. But as I said before, we have that common bond, and that is the foremost. And it's really, you know, evident. And you'll have seen that yourself with the support on that private Facebook group page. When, you know, somebody needs it, you know, everybody, you know, is there, willing and really having that person's back and just really wanting to, you know, help if they can. And I always believe that the offers of help are so genuine. You know, it's very easy to say, oh, well, you know, give us a shout if you need anything. But I really, really believe, you know, and it's followed up with other things, you know, that might not be seen. But I do, you know, everybody, because we've all been there, you know, and that's it. You know, that is our common ground.
Yeah, totally, 100% is. And, you know, I think that's the thing, that sometimes people are very good at saying, you know, if you need anything, give me a shout. But, you know, realistically, how many people genuinely do mean that? And, you know, in that group of women, you know, I see it, and, you know, it's that kind of thing that you just know that it's genuine, because you know... It is something you said earlier. It's that thing where you might be going along and you might be functioning perfectly well and everything, you know, you might be just getting on with life, and there'll be something that will absolutely floor you. And it is like hitting a brick wall, isn't it? And suddenly you are back there. And it just rears up, and it's not necessarily when it's the anniversary of something, you know, it can be other things as well. And it's so nice to have a group of people that have that same bond, that, you know, I know that if I needed anything, I could just put a post in that group and I would get a response.
No, it is. It's great. And, you know, and that's what it is. It's all about. And, you know, as you say, you know, that it's never going to leave us. This is something now that's become part of us, and we're all at different stages within it. And again, that's what's so great about the group, that there's always going to be somebody that has already maybe experienced what you're talking about. And to get that, for me, I remember some of the things that I did, to hear that somebody else had done those things, like leaving, you know, standing in the supermarket and the song a song came on the, you know, over the tannoy or whatever, and it was one of the songs, you know, your first dance or, and, you know, something that triggered, and leaving that full shopping trolley and just walking out, you know, and yeah. It, you know, to hear other, you know, I know, you know, remember some of the things, you know, the, at the start you were a wee bit embarrassed to maybe say things that you had, and then very quickly when you start to talk to other, you know, members of the association, you realize actually, you know, the people's either done much more stranger things than I've done, or they've done the exact same thing as I've done. And
yeah,
especially that
but they're not strange. The thing is, I mean, you think they are, because until you speak to somebody else who's had those experiences. I mean, it's something really weird happened as I was getting ready to set this interview up today, is that my song, the thing that used to make me absolutely just dissolve, is... Lionel Richie, you know, the Commodores, Three Times a Lady.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was number one when Gary and I got married. And he, every time that we used to have a smooch at the end of, a, you know, a night out or whatever, when the slow records came on, he would sing it to me very badly, I must add, because he couldn't sing. But, you know, it didn't matter. He, you know, he was, you know, my husband, and he was singing, you know, this wonderful song to me and everything. And I've actually got, I had to fight to get it done, because you know, having a war gravestone, you know, they have this, all this paperwork. I'm sure you've been there with this whole thing, you know. Yeah. You're only allowed to have so many words or so many letters, and, you know, all this, that, and the other. And I said, oh, no, that's not good enough. I can't have that, because I had to include, you know, our daughter. I had to include his mum and dad. I had to include everybody, but I also had to put these. And so I took some of the words of that record, and they're actually on his gravestone. And then I just changed the end bit, and it, the end bit says, "We'll never be apart." So, you know, every time I heard that record, exactly that. I don't think I've ever quite left a whole trolley full of shopping in a supermarket, but, you know, it's usually somewhere out that I hear that one. But you know what? It came on the radio just before I came on to do this.
Oh, wow.
And I have not, and I thought, you little devil, you're up there. You know,
there's always these signs.
Yeah, that's your sense of humour. And it was, and this, and even now, this, you know, this feeling welled up inside me. And, you know, because it's our record, it'll always be our record. And so, yeah, you know, it's just so good to be able to share all those kind of experiences with people that really do get it. And you know, there's been things that you have said, and I go, did you do that? Yeah, I did that too. Oh my goodness, you know. And I think one of them, which is not necessarily the best, but it just is what it is that, you know, trying to be both mum and dad.
Mm-hmm.
And giving too much in the wrong ways, and, you know, all this kind of trying to make up for that person not being there. And the reality is, you never can.
No, and that's right. And, you know, that is something definitely with my kids, you know, you find yourself overcompensating, and, you know, you want them to have everything. You don't want them, because you just feel that they're already missing something so big, and you just don't like the thought of them needing or wanting. But it's so difficult, and that, you know, at different stages of them, you know, as they grow up, you find the different challenges. And certainly more probably related to, for my son, you know, as he's become, you know, he's due to turn 20 and obviously a young man, and, you know, it's getting that balance of being the overprotective mum, but also at the same time, is this something that boys maybe do, you know, and they go out on the nights out, and, you know, you're trying to kind of sort of what would, and it's always, I think, you know, what would Matt have said about this? And, oh, you know, and at the end of the day, it's like every child, you know, they push the boundaries, and they're going to push, and it's at times like that you just think, oh, you know, I really could do with them being here to do the dad thing, I suppose. So no, you're right. That whole role of trying to be mum and dad from every sense of the word isn't easy. It's
It's not. And you know, one of the things that has been very special for me in the involvement I've had with the Falklands, and as you know, I write the blog now. Is that over time I and to research the blog, especially when it, you know, parachute regiment, I can get access to two para, mm-hmm. three para, I can network very easily for obvious reasons, but yeah. you know, it took a long time for people to really get who I was and what I was doing, you know, in terms of the Navy and, you know, Marines and, you know, mm-hmm. other sort of services, yeah. and sort of, it's amazing to me, but it's also been very healing for me because, you know, it is what it is. It's everybody's experience is their own unique experience. And, mm-hmm. you know, as part of that, I've spoken to, you know, children that were babies when their dad died, you know, so they're not going to have any memory at all, which no. I mean, obviously Angel doesn't have, you know, because she wasn't around. And, and yet, I feel so privileged that so many people have shared, not necessarily stuff that I make public, because everybody knows me well enough to know now that they tell me everything in complete confidence. And then there is a check, you know, are you okay about this? And yeah. sometimes when I talk to guys, you know, veterans, whatever, or, you know, people who tell me things, I'll say, I don't think you want that in the blog, do you? You know, and we have a laugh about it, but I think, you know, it's been wonderful to hear the experiences of brothers and sisters and, uh-huh. and parents and children of service personnel that have been killed, because, you know, it's a different relationship and it's coming from a different place, isn't it? Uh-huh.
Definitely, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that, you know, obviously all the relationships are, you know, completely different. And, you know, it must be really interesting, though, to be able to have that opportunity to talk to people about that.
I didn't think about, you know, when I started doing it, it was just something that initially I started, and I just saw a lot of people were passing over. And, you know, as you know, I was terribly ill and nearly didn't make it a couple of times, and, you know, your own mortality shoved right in your face and you realize actually what's going to happen to us all eventually, you know. But there was a lot of veterans that were starting to, you know, cross the bar, whatever you want to call it, you know, enter Valhalla, as you know, mm-hmm. we say. And, you know, initially I started writing the blog because I realized that there's a lot about the Falklands that isn't out there. And I call it the forgotten war because, you know, it was a full-blown war, you know. It may have been over so quickly, war was never actually declared, but I will certainly never call it a conflict. In fact, to me, there is a conflict in calling me a war widow of a war that was not, you know. It doesn't make any sense. So I started writing the blog because I wanted to have a little kind of like something about, you know, the 255 that we lost and, you know, the three civilian ladies. And then it sort of grew and I started adding in a few veterans. And so bit by bit, you know, it's almost like a full-time job and I absolutely love it. And that's been the positive side of this horrible COVID thing this year for me, is that, you know, I've been so wrapped up in what I've been doing, which is like a full-time job, you know, that it's just me carry on doing what I've been doing, you know. And it's something that no matter what I'm feeling or how active PTSD is or isn't, you know, I can always get on with that. And yeah, I feel really privileged at how much and how many people have shared their stories with me. You know, it's amazing. And being a blog, it's something that can be added to.
Yeah, that is the beauty of this, isn't it? That you can keep adding to it, and it is creating that kind of story, that sort of record. I think obviously we've spoken about that, you know, how easy that, you know, things in the past, if they're not recorded, can just disappear. And it's, you know, history is, you know, such an important thing for all of us. And it's, you know, especially in the sense, you know, when I think about it in relation to, that's what I think, I suppose I was talking about with Angel, you know, trying to create that kind of memory there. So building that picture, so that even long after when I've gone, you know, and if you know, my kids go on to have kids and, you know, they'll be able to kind of look back and hopefully see some form of record that will tell the story, you know, and it's about keeping that memory alive as much as you can.
Well, it's very important. It's part of your history. And it's yeah. something that, you know, with the 100 Year Challenge page that I run, we quite often, I mean, I've got access to all the records and that's what I do a lot of my research on, except I have to say Scotland is terrible. getting access to Scottish records is not as easy. But, you know, it's something we get messages about, you know, because I've got a fantastic lady. I'll give her a mention because she's so amazing. She does our daily posts of the fallen, Christina Drummond, and she posts on a few different veterans and you know, remembrance pages online. And we frequently get people contact us and question, is there any way that we can help? And because it's very difficult if it's Fred Smith.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you go into the records, you know, you could have 101. And, you know, one of the other ones in World War One was Reginald, you know, and the names that were very popular at the time.
No chance.
But if somebody's got either the service number or they've got a very unusual name, then I can often find them. If the record's there, I can find it. And, you know, people are just so, they're like, thank you so much. Because if they don't have access to those sort of records themselves, you know, and very often things sort of crop up that they didn't know and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. And what is sad to me is that we often get people that want us to try and help them, and because things have been lost in the family.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said this to a friend of mine the other day. I said, you know, unfortunately, when people die, unless you have got people who are within the family keeping these things alive, then what happens is when somebody gets old, especially if they're kind of the last in that generation, the house clearance comes in and everything goes. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
doesn't it? Yeah. All the photos, yeah. Everything just goes.
Well, it doesn't mean anything to them, does it? So it's, you know, they don't know the importance of that, and that's you know, the sadness of that.
Well, exactly. And I had a really, really interesting conversation with my grandson not long ago, actually, because, you know, I've got a row of bodybuilding trophies on my mantelpiece, and and, you know, he was looking at them and he was asking me questions, and I said where? But I said, you know, nobody will want them after I'm gone. He said, I will. And I said will you, darling? And he said, oh yes, Nana. I said, well, what if when you sort of get older and you get married or you have a girlfriend and she doesn't want them around? And he looked at me, so it's that thoughtfulness in the freeness of the child thought, you know, because he's sort of 12 now. And he said, well, I guess I put them in a box and I keep them nicely in a cupboard. And I just thought it was so sweet. And, you know, because he's adamant, you know, that's who you used to be.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, bless.
You know, so for me, in my history is I was that bodybuilder in inverted commas, yeah. You know, and, yeah. You know, for those people who served in the military, whatever, you know, part of it they did, that's who they were. Yeah. And so it is about those memories. And when we can keep those memories alive, I think it is a very special thing, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. Well, no, it is. It's so important. And I just, yeah. And I think especially for us as well, that, you know, keeping that memory alive of your, you know, your husband, to me, it's the best thing I can do. You know, it's the most, I often say that, you know, a lot of people always comment that I live life to the full, and I always say, well, I'm living for two, because I just think that, you know, I'm the lucky one that I'm here. So I'm jolly well going to just live it and make sure that I live it for Matt as well. So I think, you know, and part of that is creating memories and, you know, to keep him alive. And a lot of folk do comment, you know, even sort of obviously coming sort of 17 years down the line, he is still very much part of us, you know, today as well. And he always will be as long as I'm here. And it's something that you hope that will continue, you know, when the time comes that you're not able to do it.
I think that's so important. And, you know, for me now, it's been 38 years. And, wow. I look back on it and I just think, where did that go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where did it go? You know?
I know. It's so scary because, as you know, some days it just feels like yesterday. And then another day, it's just like another lifetime, you know? It is scary, very scary how quickly time can pass.
Well, it may not have been the best day of our lives, Raquel, when we got that knock on the door, but
no.
Amazing things do come out of tragedy, and you know,
definitely.
You and I would never have met had we not had that shared experience, would we?
So no, exactly, and you know that is, you know, I do look, and not that. No, you know, people say that expression, things happen for a reason. I find it very hard to think of a reason that, you know, somebody that you love so much is taken from you. But you do look at the positives in, I think you have to. And certainly you have to turn a lot of things into positives. And as you say, you know, many friendships have been formed. And it's that old expression, is it what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I certainly think, you know, we're certainly a group of women, a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, in our own rights, we all should take a pat on the back to, you know, at times. I don't think we're very good at that.
I think you deserve a particularly huge pat on the back because you do incredible work for the Army Widows Association. You really do. And, you know, it's so apparent that you're never very far away in terms of being there for anybody. And that is very special within itself. And I know that the plan is for you being chair coming to an end in April next year. Is that a definite?
Well, yeah, at the moment that is the kind of plan, and there's other kind of avenues that I can maybe take my link with the association further. So that's, I'm in the process of looking at that, and probably there's still life in the old dog yet, as they say. I've still got a bit to give. So
I don't know about a bit to give. I think you've got one of the biggest hearts in a person I've ever met, quite honestly. It's been incredible getting to know you, and
likewise.
I thank you so much for being so open and candid today. It's a tough subject, but you know, it is our remembrance month coming up. And so I think a lot of people will be able to relate to a lot of what's been said today. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Not at all. Pleasure's all mine, Jay. And just want to say you're doing an absolutely amazing job. You're fantastic at what you do. So keep it up.
Thank you. That concludes episode 4 of Alternate Realities. A huge thanks to Raquel today for joining us and sharing her story in such an open and honest way. Two widows talking about their experiences, very different experiences, one 17 years ago, one 38 years ago, and yet there are similarities. There always are with loss. The Knock on the Door study that you hear us talk about is being conducted by a professor at Northumberland University. It looks into the effects of that knock on the door. And everybody has an individual relationship with the person that they lose. So whenever somebody dies, they are a son to somebody or a daughter to somebody, or they are a wife or they are a husband or a brother, or, you know, there's so many different permutations to the relationships, especially now as women go into harm's way as we deploy them into places across the world. So, you know, there potentially is a lot of knock-on effects, especially for children that will never have memories of their fathers, that will never be able to share memories in the way that we can today when we're filming things on our iPhones. So, you know, looking back over many, many years, I'm hoping this knock on the door study will really bring to light some of the difficulties that families face, and therefore be able to bring some suggestions and some different ways of supporting families through what is an incredibly difficult grieving process.
Thank you for listening today, and episode 5 will be with you shortly.